science and technology in our lives. Then throw in some culture, history, ethics, philosophy, and religion. That's Spark Dialogue Podcast, where it all comes together. I'm Elizabeth Fernandez. A world away from here, a group of Buddhist monks wearing bright maroon robes and with close-cropped hair gather around a series of pictures of stars, galaxies, and nebula. Grinning from ear to ear, they discuss the nature of time, the life cycle of stars, and the scale of the universe. Today we are joined by Dr. Chris Impey. Chris had the opportunity to travel to India to teach Tibetan monks cosmology for a program called Science for Monks. Besides being an observational cosmologist, Chris is a university distinguished professor and associate dean of science for the University of Arizona. He also received a four-year grant from the Templeton Foundation to research issues on science and religion. Today, he joins us to talk about his experience in working with the monks. So welcome to the podcast, Chris.
Yeah, I'm pleased to be here.
So how did this come about? How did you get recruited to go to India and to teach the monks science?
Sure. I've taught in a whole variety of situations. I like to vary my diet outside the university. I got a call pretty much out of the blue from a guy called Bryce Johnson, who is a physics postdoc who got tapped to start this program called Science for Monks, which was fulfilling an idea of His Holiness the Dalai Lama to educate monks, Buddhist and Tibetan monks, for the 21st century by giving them math and science training, because it's not part of the monastic tradition.
Okay.
Bryce wanted to recruit a handful of Western teachers to go to various locations in India for 3 or 4 week workshops with several dozen monks, and then after the first time, nuns as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I got the invitation, it's not the kind of thing you think about. You just sort of figure out how you're going to do it and go.
Right. So what is the Dalai Lama's interest in science, and what was his motivation for inviting these teachers to come and teach science and mathematics to the monks and the nuns?
So the Dalai Lama has a very strong and a long-standing interest in science. In his autobiography, you can read that when he was 4 or 5 years old and still living in Tibet, he would take his parents' clocks and mechanical devices apart and put them together again. And he pretty much says that if he had not been chosen at a young age to be the 15th Bodhisattva of compassion reincarnated, he would have been an engineer. So he's got a technical mind, and he's recognized that the Tibetans are in a tricky position with no homeland, with their refugees. Their culture is under threat and sort of being dismantled in China. And more importantly, the monastic tradition is venerable, but doesn't really include science and math. So he just thought that was an anachronism, that his monks and nuns needed to be educated for the 21st century. And so to execute that with no science expertise within the community, you know, he had to bring in some Western teachers to start that process.
That's great. That's great. So where did you go?
The first time was close to the seat of power, if you like, of the Tibetan government in exile. So Dharamsala, a hill town in northern India, is where the Tibetan government in exile is and has been since 1959. Mm-hmm. And just down the hill from His Holiness's main temple and the government buildings, there's a little teaching college. And so the workshop was in that teaching college.
Okay. So when you were there, did you fully embrace the monastic lifestyle of the monks, or what was it like to live there?
Yes and no. When you teach, and I've been there now a number of times, I think 7 or 8, I lose track. And each workshop's in a different location, so I've seen some interesting parts of India. Typically, we're not fully in the monastery itself, but we're in the sort of outer sanctum, if you like, of the monastery. So we eat our meals with the monks and nuns. You know, we hang out with them in the evenings. We're staying in pretty Spartan circumstances. You know, it's India. The infrastructure's not great. So, you know, there may or may not be hot water. There's a lot of bugs. There may or may not be electricity. It goes out all the time. Beds are pretty simple. You know, we need mosquito nets because of the malaria. So it's a, you know, our circumstances are not much more luxurious than the monks themselves, I think.
Okay. So when you were living there, was there anything about their lifestyle or anything about their worldview that you found surprising or that you learned when you were there?
Well, I, of course, encountered a lot of being in a monastery. Usually you're in or near a very big monastery. Only a small fraction of those monks and nuns are in the program. So I would run into other monastics, some of whom didn't have very much English, so you couldn't have a conversation. Yeah, I learned that they're very curious. They're even if they weren't in our program, the Tibetan tradition and Buddhism in general is a very empirical worldview. I mean, going back to the Buddha as a historical figure who said you should look at the way the world is, not the way you think it should be or the way I tell you it is. So Buddhism has no dogma, has no theology, and it's a very empirical worldview, which sort of meshes with science quite well. So they're very curious. They're skeptical, as you would expect of science students and hope for. They're open to pretty much anything. They can handle pretty wild, abstract ideas because the monks are trained for a decade in philosophy, rhetoric, and many of the world traditions of religion. So they're pretty nimble thinkers.
So sounds like a good student to have.
Yeah, and the last part, of course, is that they're indefatigable because they, they're, again, not living a very rich lifestyle, but their stamina for learning is enormous. So they would typically be getting up at 5:30 in the morning for prayers and have done a couple of hours of prayers and meditation before breakfast, and then we'd be in the classroom at 8 o'clock, and we'd run pretty much 8 hours through the day with an hour and a half off for lunch and tea breaks. And often there'd be evening session as well. And sometimes they had obligations when they went back to the monastery late at night. So I sort of wondered how much sleep they got.
Yeah, indeed. So let's talk a little bit about the program that you actually taught. So what were the goals that you wanted to have, and what kind of things did you teach the monks?
So the overarching goals of the program and the curriculum, if you like, was sort of defined by His Holiness's interest. And so the main topics, and they vary slightly from workshop to workshop, are math, physics, developmental biology, neuroscience, astronomy. And so they're getting some life science, some physical science, and the actual curriculum depends on what teachers go out. So it's only ever a handful. It's usually three or four of us. So we're sort of interleaving our classes. And we're starting from scratch. They have more or less eighth grade math. Mm-hmm. So it can't be heavily mathematical, but their conceptual capabilities are very high level. So their technical skills are poor, but their conceptual skills are extremely good. And that means you can challenge them with sophisticated concepts. You just can't grind through the math. So it's a different kind of teaching. The program that Bryce Johnson runs, the Science for Monks program, is also geared towards pedagogy that's not transmissive. You know, in the Western educational world, there's, you know, kind of a jaundiced view of lecturing as not being an efficient way to learn. It's the way most happens in most universities for the most part. So he sort of selected instructors, people like me, who have done a lot of interactive and student-centered learning methods. Mm-hmm. In our classroom, you know, I would try to lecture as little as possible, and we do activities or hands-on things or experiments with pretty simple equipment because, again, there's no sophisticated equipment available. It was a pretty hands-on type classroom to get them involved, to get them moving around, to get people working in groups and so on.
Okay. So what parts of cosmology or what parts of astronomy did you try to focus on teaching?
So in astronomy, you'd start with positional astronomy. So, you know, just the usual stuff that might be covered in the first few weeks of an introductory astronomy class at a big college. Motions in the night sky, phases of the moon, eclipses. I took out a couple of times, we had little Galileo scopes, these little, you know, small telescopes that were upgraded versions of Galileo's technology. And so there's some positional astronomy, and pretty much we cover, you know, planets, stars, galaxies. Some workshops I focused on cosmology particularly, and so I deal with much more the big scales of the universe, time and space itself, relativity, the nature of the universe as a whole. And they like that subject. They're very much drawn to that subject. And then if possible, given the limitations of time, I try and cover astrobiology because they were clearly very interested in the fact that we're finding thousands of planets and Earth-like planets and the likelihood of life elsewhere in the universe. They were really interested in that, as are most members of the public.
Mm-hmm. So before you start teaching them, what is their concept of the universe? Do they understand that the Earth is going around the sun, or there's one of many different types of planets that are around other stars as well?
So that's a good question, because I actually found that out for not every workshop, but half of the workshops on the very first day, I give them all a blank piece of paper and say, draw the universe as mm-hmm. you understand it. And many of them had not had science formally at all. They were interested, but they had not had classes. A few had. And those drawings showed at a large range. And I would say about half of those drawings reflected a geocentric, you know, pre-Copernican view of the universe with the Earth at the center. Mm-hmm. The Tibetan version of that is Mount Meru, this sort of wedding cake-shaped mountain with a temple on it. It's not even just geocentric. It's sort of flat Earth as well. And so not all of them, but a good fraction would represent that. Hardly any would represent anything beyond the solar system. They might center a few planets and the sun and the moon in there, but the fraction or the number that would represent galaxies was a handful out of maybe 30. So okay. They really were working from a sort of archaic view of the universe.
Yeah. So when you were there, what do you think was your biggest challenge in teaching the monks?
I think the biggest challenge was really their lack of technical preparation, the fact that, you know, you couldn't really use math. So, I mean, obviously you can't be non-mathematical and teach science properly. So I actually spend a lot of time with estimation. You know, I mean, we do very simple things like I'd bring in a bucket of sand and they estimate how many sand grains in the bucket. And then we'd lay out grains of sand on little sheets of graph paper and they actually calculate how many sand grains could be in a cubic centimeter and they'd work it out. So estimation and simple calculations, volumes, areas, orders of magnitude, we do a lot of that, little geometry. So, you know, those were big challenges because their math skills were either non-existent or very rusty and they just were not nimble with numbers or used to working with numbers. The other challenge is that none of the ideas really tethered in pre-existing instruction. Even when you talk about astronomy to college students in the U.S. who are music majors or people not with a science interest, you know, they've had science at high school and middle school. They know stuff. They read around on the web and so on. The monks, really, many of them had no awareness of 20th and 21st century astronomy or cosmology. So everything was new to them. And that's fresh. I mean, that's good in a sense. And they're open to the information. But it's a lot. It's like a fire hose. So the pace of the workshops, even though they have a lot of stamina and an appetite for it, that was a challenge for them. And you could see that sometimes struggling to digest all this brand new information because all of it was brand new.
Yeah, I can imagine because it's not only learning information, but also changing the way you're seeing the universe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of jargon. And so the method of the classroom is, which I didn't mention, is their English would be variable. The best, you know, the top 10 or 15% of the monks you could talk to, you know, all evening in English, no problem. The low end would be hard, very stilted conversation. They all had some English. But the method of the workshop was you would have a translator at your side and you'd just speak in short bursts and it would be translated into Tibetan. Mm-hmm. And so you couldn't cover as much ground as if you were just talking in English nonstop. So the language was an issue. The terminology was an issue. We spent, you know, we'd have to sidebar and take a while to translate a technical term, especially a physics term that didn't have a simple Tibetan equivalent. So that was another challenge, that the terminology in science just sometimes has no simple counterpart in Tibetan.
We'll get back to Chris in a moment. But first, remember that March is Tripod Month.
A message from the American Podcast Council.
Every month, one out of five Americans listens to a podcast, and that's fantastic. But friend, we can do better. All this month, we want you to find one of those four Americans who doesn't listen to podcasts. A friend, a relative, the only cool coworker in your office. Find that person and explain to them, slowly but gently, what a podcast is, where to find one, and then how to listen to it. When you complete that mission, tell us what you recommended with the hashtag tripod. That's TRYPOD.
And now, back to our podcast. So, looking at Buddhism itself, I know Buddhism has a lot of unique perspectives on the universe. So, did any ideas from Buddhism strike you as having sort of unique connections with science and with cosmology?
There are certainly ideas of Buddhism that were consonant with cosmology and with physics that were not in disagreement with it, that were receptive to the ideas that I was presenting. Among them is the idea that the Buddhism contemplates many worlds. So it's uncontroversial to them that the Earth is not a unique world in space. They don't have, you know, a physical and numerical sense of the size of the Buddhist universe. It's just very conceptual. But they're completely comfortable with the idea of many worlds, millions or billions of worlds, and also with the idea that those worlds could be inhabited, have life, that they're, you know, that there's not unique, that even our form of life is not unique, or that we are preeminent amongst life forms in their universe. So that's all very modern. They're also familiar with time. So unlike, you know, a young Earth tradition or some literalist biblical interpretations, Buddhism encompasses time spans of millions, of billions, and sometimes even trillions of years. A grand kalpa in Buddhism is a cosmic cycle of about a trillion years. And then within that are billion-year cycles. So they're totally comfortable with all the cosmological timescales that I was talking about. They posit an endless universe of cycling of birth and death and rebirth. And modern cosmology does have the Big Bang, but there's frontier work that also includes the idea of many universes and the Big Bang not being the beginning of everything. So even that's not against modern cosmology. So in all those huge, the hugeness of time and space, everything just fit quite comfortably. Life in the universe, no problem. Many worlds, no problem. So that was interesting. They were totally ready and easy to receive that information.
Yeah. Something that I found very interesting is this understanding of time and the cyclic nature of the universe that is in Buddhism. And I know one of the cycles is, isn't it about the length of the history of the Earth? And then there's a longer one that's even the history of the entire universe.
Yes, there's a sort of kalpa, a regular kalpa that's in some historical document. It's actually quoted as 4.32 billion years, which is strikingly close to the age of the Earth. I mean, that's a coincidence, but it's that order of magnitude. And then the billion-year timescale is a grand kalpa, which is a sort of day in the life of Brahma. And then there's the life of Brahma, and it's where you get to the trillion-year timescales. And so they put numbers on these in some of the texts, and they talk about birth and death within that context. But probably the concept that's core to their tradition that has, you know, the least situation in modern science is karma. You know, the idea of a sort of cosmic moral force that propagates through life forms and has a currency of its own. Now, obviously, science can't necessarily disprove the idea of karma, but it's beyond science.
Mm-hmm. So when you're looking at cosmology and science in one hand and the Buddhist understanding in the other, do you think that each of these have any fundamental limitations?
Well, they each have their own type of limitation. Science, I mean, as a scientist, I can say that, you know, the scientific understanding of the universe is limited in a number of ways. It's limited by our position in time and space. There's parts of the universe that we think exist in the theory that we will never see, that we can never see because of light travel time or because of the finite time since the Big Bang. Mm-hmm. There are parts of the universe that are inaccessible because they lie beyond a horizon. So this multiverse idea, or the fact that there are, you know, regions that are just invisible to us, even in principle. And then, you know, unless we're very arrogant, there are aspects of the universe we might not understand well and never understand because our theories aren't good enough. So we know we're not dealing with the fundamental theory of gravity, for instance, because it does not incorporate quantum effects. So physics and cosmology are both limited by imperfect and incomplete theories. So that's what the scientists deal with. The Buddhists are not limited in the same way because they can conceive of anything. They are very aware of human limitations too, and they don't consider humans to be the end and pinnacle of creation and evolution and so on. So that's a deviation also from some of the Western traditions that clearly think we're special and on top of the pile and have a preeminent relationship, for instance, with our creator in the sort of Judeo-Christian tradition. So Buddhists don't think that way at all. There's nothing super special about humans in that regard, because we're just, you know, your human form is a way station towards something else. And, you know, you just deal with the cards you were dealt and then live according to the Eightfold Way or whatever precepts of Buddhism should guide the way you live your life.
Okay. So what did you learn when you were there?
So there was many things I learned. I'll point out that early on when I was being recruited, even now back in 2008, almost 10 years ago, Bryce, in a sort of casual way, said, he asked me if I was a Buddhist. I think he knew it wasn't. And I said, no, I'm not. I've read a book or two. And he said, that's good, because we don't want Buddhist wannabes in this program. And he was joking, but what he was really referring to is the fact that, well, he was referring to a couple of things. He was referring to the fact that Western Buddhists are sometimes viewed with an amused and jaundiced eye by Buddhists in Asia, because they've got a quite different variation of the religion. And he also was meaning, I think more importantly, that he wanted the Western educators and scientists to come to the encounter fresh, without preconceptions, without thinking that they know the religion and that they can fit the science into the religion and so on. He wanted it to be a true dialogue, which was a smart way to go. So as far as learning, I mean, I of course learned a lot about their tradition. I learned that my, say, naive understanding of what karma was hopelessly antiquated and simplistic. So I got a much more nuanced idea of how their philosophy works. I also got an appreciation and understanding for how they, you know, live their lives. I learned, of course, a lot about Tibetan culture and history and, you know, things, some things I knew a little and some things I didn't know at all. And so, yeah, it's a learning process pretty much every day when you're out there.
Right. What about on a personal level, something that might have, you know, changed the way you saw the universe or changed the way you lived your life?
Well, I think the best thing that I took away and still take away from the workshops, but it was very striking the first time, is that, you know, I'm embedded in a very intense Western scientific culture at a research university like mine. You know, science it's not always a blood sport, but it's very competitive. It's hard to get funding. Mm-hmm. It's hard tenure. You're fighting for students. You're fighting for space and turf in various ways. You're competing with rival groups around the world to get the science out and to be first and for the baubles of the profession. So that sort of slightly aggressive competitiveness, sort of a hallmark of Western science, is absent, of course, from the Tibetan and Buddhist mindset. They're not competitive. They are extremely engaged in learning, and they could be mocking to each other when someone said something silly or erroneous in the classroom, but it was very affectionately done. And so they were very collaborative rather than competitive. So that's one thing. You know, they just sort of set a different context for learning, where it was very collaborative, it was very light and you know, never far away from humor or just not getting too caught up in it. And so, you know, it casts a light on how you've been living your life and all of those things. And some things are just not important to them. I mean, they're just taking a bigger picture. Their lens of what they're doing at that moment or their whole life is just different, because they can always drop back to this sort of cosmic Buddhist perspective that it's just, you know, they're just a little drop in this karmic ocean and their life is just one of an endless cycle of lives. And that doesn't mean they don't get seriously and live their life to the fullest and have intentionality in what they do, but if they can always let it go. It's that detachment thing, you know, which is also part of Buddhism.
Right. So from what it sounds like you're saying, it sounds like that scientists in general could have a lot possibly to learn from these monks as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously restorative to go to a place where, well, first of all, there's internet doesn't usually work, where you're almost off the grid. There's no alcohol, you're not, it's a vegetarian diet, it's very cleansing to your systems. Uh-huh. It's sort of like going, you know, to a spa, except not a very luxurious. and so that's interesting. And you're also taken away from all the distractions of academic life and the Western world and the obsession of social media and politics. It's like an amniotic fluid, all that's gone, you know? I mean, you can dip into it a little bit, but not much. So that's refreshing. And then the other thing, of course, perspective they provide is that they are not just supplicants at the, you know, at the well of Western science drinking until they're full. They are also questioning. They're skeptical, as their tradition encourages. And so one of the things that the Dalai Lama has pushed back against in some of his writings about science is the overly materialistic aspect of Western science. And the fact that it, as we all know, science tends to ask how we could do X, Y, or Z, but not whether we should do X, Y, or Z. Yeah. So science is mechanistic, it's reductionist, it's acquisitive, it's kind of aggressive, it's a questing activity. And to have a more contemplative perspective on it, where you don't always do the things you could do because they're not a good idea, or you put the ethical principle first, or you decide that it's sometimes better just not to do that thing. You know, they're always making that point. And then on the reductionist aspect, they're just gently pointing out, from His Holiness on down to some of the other scholars, they're just pointing out that the reductionist agenda of science has not really succeeded anyway. It hasn't explained the brain. It hasn't explained the fundamental nature of life at the level of biology. It hasn't explained why we're here as opposed to how we may have evolved. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're just willing to point these things out, that science is not this overpowering thing that will eventually subject all knowledge and information in the universe to its framework.
Right. Well, it sounds like it's quite an amazing experience you had. And for listeners who might want to learn more, Chris has a book about his time with the monks. It's called Humble Before the Void. So, Chris, thank you for joining us for the podcast today.
Sure, it was a pleasure.
If you want to see some pictures of the monks learning science and hanging out with Einstein, or read more information about Chris and his book, check out sparkdialogue.com/scienceformonks. This is Elizabeth Fernandez for Spark Dialogue Podcasts. Remember, this March is Tripod Month. Podcasts provide information and entertainment, often for free. So show them some love in return by subscribing, giving them a nice rating, and sharing them with your friends. For this podcast, you can find us on iTunes and many other locations that you love to listen to your podcasts. You can also find us on the web at sparkdialogue.com, on facebook.com/sparkdialogue, and on Twitter @sparkdialogue. As always, thanks for listening.